many of these countries found China less than an entirely reliable trading partner.
China and the EU are apparently experiencing trade troubles. This is Wednesday, September 16th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, the COVID-19 pandemic made life very difficult for a VOA Asia intern. One of the hardest hit medical treatments hampered by the pandemic is going to the dentist. The number of gun owners in the U.S. is heading up quickly. And you'll hear why fewer restaurants mean fewer performance jobs in New York City. It is all on today's VOA Asia. Europe has called on China to take down trade barriers and rebalance the economic relationship following a virtual summit held Monday between EU leaders and Chinese President Xi Jinping. EU officials also raised human rights issues, including the crackdown on protest in Hong Kong. But Beijing is rejecting any interference in its affairs. Henry Ridgewell has more from London.
The glitz of an international summit downgraded to a virtual conference. EU and Chinese leaders had planned to hold face-to-face talks in Germany, but the resurgent coronavirus pandemic meant that was changed to a video link between two top EU officials, German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Speaking after the meeting, European leaders reiterated demands for China to open up its markets.
Europe needs to be a player, not a playing field. Today's meeting represents another step forward in forging a more balanced relationship with China.
We expect that the market access barriers in China will be removed.
Europe sees its current trade relationship with China as deeply unfair, but is not seeking a trade war, says analyst Steve Tsang.
I think COVID-19 has changed a lot of things in terms of relationship with China. Many of these countries found China less than an entirely reliable trading partner or supplier of essential goods like medical supplies. So some of that will change, but they really don't want to have an economic decoupling with China.
But the trade talks were overshadowed by growing criticism of China's human rights record. The EU has called on Beijing to end its clampdown on pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong. And Europe has voiced growing alarm over China's treatment of the Muslim Uyghur population in Xinjiang province, where human rights groups say millions of people are being detained. While China denies the accusations, German Chancellor Angela Merkel says Europe will continue to raise the issue.
The human rights dialogue will continue. Chinese President Xi Jinping offered this, so there are already points of contact for further joint action. But that does not mean that there is agreement on these issues.
Chinese state media reports that President Xi Jinping has rejected any interference in Chinese affairs, particularly on human rights. The relationship is strained, says Tsang.
Governments generally and the EU as a whole also take a more robust stance, reflecting the shift in public opinion towards China.
With the EU as China's top trading partner, analysts say Beijing wants to avoid further disputes amid its trade war with the United States. For its part, Brussels says it will continue to bring up security and human rights concerns, even as it seeks more trade. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Tuesday he's confident there will be effective 5G competitors to China's Huawei from Western vendors at comparable cost. The U.S. State Department eases a travel advisory for Americans considering travel to China or Hong Kong. Humpback whales are found in a crocodile-infested Australian river. Millions of children in Pakistan returned to schools and universities after a six-month-long closure, the largest return to school in the world. A new U.S. survey finds two-thirds of supporters of President Trump strongly or somewhat supporting his deal with the Islamist Taliban. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the VOANews.com website. You're listening to VOA Asia. We have documented the many challenges facing both students and parents deciding whether or not to send those students back to school as the COVID-19 pandemic continues. One of our interns at VOA Asia has faced an even more trying experience. Ji-hee Wu came to us in Washington, D.C. from South Korea. I spoke with her about her experiences. You have one of the most unusual internships of anyone we've ever had at the Voice of America. What happened?
This year was pretty tough for the whole world. And for as an intern from abroad, it was also a very tough time, I would say. So usually what we expect when I am in the United States and doing an intern would be like experiencing the workplace and getting a chance to get along with like other people, and that's what I've expected. But since the pandemic started, I couldn't go to work, and I wasn't even sure that I could go to work, because actually my government was pressing me to go back to South Korea, and I was the one actually signed up the waiver and said that I'm not going to go back. I kind of refused.
What was the waiver?
So the waiver was this. So like for the program, they were kind of pushing everyone who was attending this program to go back to South Korea, because they were not going to guarantee our health when we get coronavirus. So the waiver was about, okay, I had to sign and say that, okay, the government is not going to take any kind of responsibility when I get sick or when I get the virus, and I'm the one who have to cope with everything. And they're just like kind of giving us up.
Was that difficult? Was that difficult to make up your mind on that?
Yeah, definitely. Because first of all, my family would definitely want to let me to come back. And also, when I'm thinking logically, I should have gotten back, but I just couldn't do it, because I've dreamed of like coming to here and start my internship, and it just felt so wrong that giving up so many things if I go back. And I thought like I will lose in this circumstance if I just go back, and if I don't face this problem, then I am going to be a loser or something.
Well, what we haven't brought up yet is the pandemic and the COVID-19. You got it. How'd you get it? What did it feel like? What did it do to you?
This virus, you don't know where you get it. You just don't know. I am not sure even where I got it.
How bad was it, and what did you do to take care of it?
I felt fatigue. When I was starting working, I was like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I didn't know why, but I was very, very tired. The next day, actually, I started to have some runny nose and headaches. So I was like 100% sure I got the virus. So I did my quarantine since then. And I went up to the testing site, and I got the virus. They told me that I got the virus. And that was the day I started to feel some shortness of breath and also lots of chest pains.
So how did you take care of it? Did you just ride it out? Did you see a doctor? What happened?
I couldn't go to the hospital. I knew that they cannot do anything for me because there is no treatment for coronavirus. Fortunately, I did not have fever, and I did have my medicine kit in my house. So I didn't go to the doctor. What I did was eat lots of vitamin C, lots and lots of vitamin C. So like I would have a good immune system so my body can fight with the virus. So yeah, I ate lots of orange, vitamin C, and I tried to eat well, but because I didn't taste anything.
So you're free of it now, right?
Yeah, done with coronavirus right now.
Ji-hee has completed her internship with us and is now making her way back home to South Korea. happening now in Asia, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo cautioned Tuesday that ongoing peace negotiations over the future of Afghanistan will be a difficult process, but will help reduce the cost of war and risk to America. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We continue on VOA Asia. The World Health Organization is releasing guidance to minimize the risk of being infected with COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
As everyone in the world can attest, having a toothache is no fun. And when the pain is bad enough, people will go to the dentist. However, a World Health Organization survey of 103 countries between May and mid-July finds COVID-19 has affected dental services around the world in unprecedented ways. Dental officer in WHO's Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, Benoit Varenne, says 75% of survey respondents reported dental services have been completely or partially disrupted because of the coronavirus. He says the high level of disruption is linked to the nature of the work provided by the oral healthcare personnel.
As you know, dentists, dental nurses, hygienists, and dental assistants work in close contact with patients and are exposed to saliva and blood. And also they are using what we call spray-generating equipment. And all this equipment are generating what we call airborne particles or aerosol.
In communities where transmission of the coronavirus is high, Varenne says WHO recommends priority be given to urgent or emergency oral cases. And in the treatment of patients, he says dental workers should avoid or minimize procedures that may generate aerosols, which can spread the infection, and prioritize the use of hand instruments.
And, of course, to delay routine, non-essential oral health care. This means oral health checkup, dental cleaning, preventive care, and certainly also some aesthetic dental treatment.
Other WHO recommendations include remote screening, maintaining physical distancing, and wearing masks before and in between dental sessions to prevent and reduce the risk of transmission. Varenne says one of the most pressing issues is to ensure all dental workers have personal protective equipment. This is essential, he says, to protect themselves from becoming infected with COVID-19 and passing it on to their patients. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
After you listen to VOA Asia, see it. VOA Asia is on YouTube. See and share the fun with Food Bites, our weekly culinary dive into foods from the homeland. Recipes that came with chefs who immigrated to the United States. Students enrolling in U.S. schools can get their first lessons about life on campus. Subscribe for free and see us often on VOA Asia YouTube.
This news from VOA Asia. The United States has blacklisted a Chinese real estate development company building a port, airport, and resort complex in Cambodia, which Washington said was built on land seized from local people, suggesting it could be turned into a military base. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. According to a report by the Brookings Institution, almost 3 million more firearms have been sold since March. There is evidence that people who have never owned guns before are lining up to get one. Elena Wolf has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Shooting range instructor Sam Barbakov helps unload guns after a busy day at a shooting gallery. These are all training guns, but he keeps his own firearm on him at all times. Barbakov believes that if you have a weapon, you should keep it handy.
Imagine someone's trying to break into your house, and you're like, hang on guys, let me go open my safe. No, the gun should always be on you.
Barbakov, who moved to the U.S. from Russia, has always loved firearms. And he's in the right place. Florida is a gun-friendly state. Floridians own 450,000 registered firearms. That's the second highest level of gun ownership in the country, behind Texas. Recently, though, even this gun-loving state has seen a major spike in sales and new gun owners since March, and it's happening all over the U.S. Americans are purchasing guns at record high numbers throughout the country. The National Instant Criminal Background Check System run by the FBI performed over 19 million background checks in the first half of the year. That's 6 million more than in the first half of 2019.
Here are some more bullets.
How long will they last you?
One class.
According to the Brookings Institution, concerns about personal safety are driving the rise in demand for guns. In March, it says buyers expressed concern about COVID and the economic downturn. More recently, authors of the report say those same fears, plus widespread protests against racial injustice sparked by the death of George Floyd, drove sales. Barbakov says the classes he teaches, called Force to Force, are especially popular these days, even though bullets and guns have become pricier. Glocks that used to cost around $400 to $500 a piece now go for between $700 and $750. In Florida, it's legal to purchase guns 3 years before it's legal to drink alcohol, and you don't need any licenses to buy one.
I'd say 95% of the people coming through the door right now are first-time gun buyers that are interested in, you know, they watch the news, they see what's going on in this country, and they're very concerned about it, and they want to be able to defend their property and themselves and their families.
Experts say spikes in firearm sales generally occur during uncertain times, and gun regulation advocates say a jump in sales will likely lead to more accidental shootings.
The reality is that the chance that you will ever use a gun to defend yourself or to defend your family is just incredibly low. I think the statistic is like 0.02%. Whereas the probability once you bring a gun into your home that you would use that gun against yourself, that you would use that gun against a loved one, increases anywhere from 300 to 500%.
Despite the risks, the number of gun and bullet sales continue to break records. Eliana Wolf in Delray Beach, Florida, NRI's VOA News.
There is no current evidence that dogs can be infected. Hand washing after contact with all animals is recommended. This protects against other bacteria such as E. coli and Salmonella that can pass between animals and humans. For more information, visit www.who.int or www.cdc.gov.
You're listening to VOA Asia. New York City has always attracted creative people, those who are happy to wait tables in the evening as long as it pays the bills, only to run to auditions and have time for their art during the day. However, the coronavirus pandemic has forced over 1,000 Big Apple restaurants to close, and that means no jobs for the New York City bohemia. Anna Nelson looked into how the New York art scene has been adapting to the new reality. Anna Rice narrates her story.
Among the tens of thousands of New York City waiters, many are aspiring artists or actors looking for a day job that'll pay the bills. They're following in the famous footsteps of artists like Sandra Bullock and Jennifer Aniston, and singers like Madonna and Mariah Carey. But over 1,000 New York City restaurants were forced to close because of COVID-19, and tens of thousands of jobs disappeared.
I used to work at Red Lobster. I still got Red Lobster. I was, I served you. Good. I was a dishwasher. Used to scrape shrimp in the garbage cans and then load up the dishwasher, man. And that was my real job.
Jen Lyon is a concert promoter. She says she has noticed fewer talented musicians available for work since COVID. Many have left New York City for good because restaurants and nightclubs are closed and can't accommodate them.
The Lady Gaga story. If Lady Gaga didn't play in small clubs in New York, we wouldn't have a Lady Gaga. Aren't we glad we have her? Bruce Springsteen. You know, I mean, all of these artists that make the stories and soundtracks of our lives, all of those artists who were working within the restaurant industry to maintain living in New York, to become artists, have now had to make different life choices and have had to leave New York.
Before the pandemic, one could spend an hour in line at restaurant Stardust on Broadway. Once inside the venue, waiters sang to entertain the customers.
You sing with all the voices of the mountain.
Today, Kevin Ray and Yulia Proshina, both former Stardust employees, are fundraising to support their fellow singer waiters.
It's about 200 plus people. Everybody is trying to find their own path right now. Some of them are creating their own music or something else. Some people are probably going in a totally different direction away from the music, which is kind of sad. We had a lot of talented people here.
The flexible work schedule allowed Kevin Ray to compose music and go on tours. Today, with future uncertain, he writes songs about 6 feet, the now notorious social distance.
It's everybody's livelihood. It's allowed us to live in this city. It's allowed us an opportunity to perform, to hone our craft, and to have fun while doing it.
Artist Rachel Berry has lived in New York for 15 years and worked many different jobs, but only bartending left her enough time and energy to focus on art.
The flexibility that comes with part-time work for full-time pay has essentially given me the creative freedom to do anything else I want on the side. I mean, you can't be creative, you can't perform, you can't write when your basic needs are in jeopardy.
I worry that we're going to lose something, and who knows if we can get it back.
According to the U.S. Department of Labor, about 270,000 people worked in New York City restaurants before the pandemic. Today, it's less than 70,000. And while the dynamic continues to be like that, fewer and fewer young talented people will be able to afford to look for their dream in New York. For Anna Nelson in New York, NRI's Daily News.
We continue on VOA Asia. By the year 2025, half of the world's population, according to the World Health Organization, will be living in areas that are considered water-stressed. Several companies are offering solutions to clean and available drinking water by looking at what is in the air. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details.
This is no ordinary water cooler. The water here comes from the air. It's something Karthik Venkatesan would love his parents in India to have.
Whenever I go to India, I always use Dasani bottled water because I get sick if I use tap water.
Having access to clean drinking water is a growing global problem. Several companies have developed technology that uses moisture in the air and transforms it into drinking water. WaterGen's technology first purifies the air of particles. The air is then cooled until it reaches dew point. The water goes through another series of filters and an ultraviolet lamp to destroy microorganisms. These bigger machines have helped supply safe drinking water in countries including Sierra Leone and Vietnam, and also in the United States during disasters such as hurricanes. This smaller unit, called the Jenny, for the home or office, can produce an average of 30 liters of water a day.
WaterGen says the humidity in the air should be around 30% to maximize what this technology can do.
When you get up closer to 50, it works brilliantly.
Higher humidity also works better for Atmospheric Water Solutions AquaBoy. Similarly, it creates drinking water while purifying the air and dehumidifying the room. Zero mass water produces drinking water from sunlight and air, even in places of low relative humidity, using these hydro panels. The technology uses solar energy to raise the dew point inside the hydro panels, creating condensation. The cost of these various products run from around $2,000 and up, which may cost too much for households in many regions in the world.
India and Africa are all price-sensitive countries, so probably this price point may not work. But if the price point is right, definitely it has huge potential.
Creating drinking water from air, one solution that could alleviate one of the most basic human needs. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Thank you for being with us. Thanks to our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy the day.